Welcome to Byline. I'm Rick Heldick. University of Louisville football coach Charlie Strong finally put an end to the rumors and speculation Thursday morning when he announced that he turned down a job offer from the University of Tennessee and will continue coaching the Cards with what will likely be a hefty raise and a contract extension. U of L athletic director Tom Jurich says he was prepared to match any other team's offers for Strong, praising his work not just on the field but on campus and in the community. Jurich says Strong's decision to stay also finally shows that U of L is a destination, not a stepping stone, as it seems to have been for some other coaches. Joining us to talk about Charlie Strong and the rest of this story is C.L. Brown, who covers U of L football and other sports for the Courier-Journal. C.L., welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
Good to have you here. Well, you know, this is just my personal observation, but in the past I haven't been really all that surprised when U of L football coaches have decided to leave for other jobs. But it seemed in this case I wasn't all that surprised that Charlie Strong decided to stay. There seemed to be a kind of a sense of wanting to finish the job.
Yeah, I mean, he's just in his third season, yeah. and as a first-time head coach, too. I think that may have played into it a little bit as well. But Charlie Strong is definitely a different kind of coach. I mean, I know maybe Bobby Petrino, the way he left, kind of left a bad stain with everybody here, but Strong is no Petrino.
Petrino, of course, left for the Atlanta Falcons in the NFL abruptly after taking the team to the Orange Bowl.
And seemingly had one foot out the door the whole time he yeah. was here with the Auburn interview, the LSU interview. So he definitely viewed this as a means to get somewhere else.
Another Cards coach, Howard Schnellenberger, famously said years ago that the team is on a collision course with the national title, and that appears to be truer than ever now with Strong. He's got Teddy Bridgewater and a lot of good players coming back.
Yes, I'm not sure that it's necessarily a collision course yet, but I think that also factored into the reason why he had to stay. I mean, Teddy Bridgewater is not just a run-of-the-mill quarterback, and most of this team right now is basically juniors and sophomores in terms of the ones who are major contributors.
So Charlie Strong is staying. He turned down an offer from Tennessee. There have been various reports as to what that offer was. We don't know any salary details yet in this contract that he's renegotiating, right?
Correct. As of yesterday morning was when Tom Jurich, athletic director at U of L, said that's the first time they actually began talking numbers.
So now some would argue that he hasn't really earned the beat. You just said he's been here for 3 years, and the schedule this year, relatively light. Some would argue that he really hasn't earned such big money as of yet.
Well, I mean, it's about market demands. Yeah. Tennessee was about to pay him, you know, a pretty good sum, upwards of $3 million to $4 million, depending on what reports you believe. So the market demands it, then you get what you're worth.
He can't apologize for
yes.
being able to earn this kind of money. Well, you know, Strong has complained in the past about fans not being in their seats at game time, and then this week he made no bones about his displeasure over the lack of turnout for the Card Walk prior to the Connecticut game, the final home game of the season and the final home game for about a dozen senior players. This is what he had to say on Monday.
If you support your program, you support your program. And you want that, and we have fans here that do support their program, and not to throw any salt on the wound. Kentucky can travel with the Big Blue Nation; they go take over. I mean, what we should have that same passion here and go take over when we go travel, and there's no reason why we shouldn't. I mean, but you know, someone told me that we're such a young program, and we have a young fan base that doesn't happen. But I don't buy that. I just think that when you're passionate about something, you go support it.
Now, Strong says U of L fans are great, but I think that rankled a few people, the comparison to a Big Blue Nation.
Oh, it definitely did. I think Charlie Strong has had a tendency to coach everybody. I mean, when we got back from the Final Four, being the media contingent in Louisville, yeah. he basically locked us out of football practice, wouldn't let us do interviews immediately after that, and his reasoning was, no one was there to cover football during the Final Four. So he was coaching us up. And I guarantee you, even though, you know, we took a step back, the next time it came, if it comes around again that way, somebody from our organizations will be there. I think it's the same thing right now with the fans. They took a step back, but a lot of them see a lot of truth in what he said.
Tom Jurich said the other day that Charlie Strong speaks his mind.
he definitely will speak his mind. But in the fans' defense, they canceled a couple of card marches during the season. So, You know, I think there's something to be said about the consistency of it. And, you know, maybe some of them thought there's a possibility that it could have been canceled before that game as well.
I know we've been talking among ourselves, is there any way to incentivize the fans to get them into the seats at kickoff here in Louisville? Or is this like a Louisville personality trait?
I think it's kind of like the Lakers games in the mid-80s, especially where, it'd just be a late arriving crowd. And I think that might just be a character trait with UofL football fans.
I think there was correct me if I'm wrong, a local eye doctor this year was offering some sort of discount if you were in your seat by a certain point.
I forgot what that promotion was, but that was earlier in the year, yes.
So back to this season, the Cards went 10-2 in the regular season, earned a berth to the Sugar Bowl, and they'll take on Florida on January 2nd, Florida, one of the top five teams in the country. You'll have a chance.
Florida could easily be in the national championship game. Yeah. There's always a chance. I think that UofL will have to play close to a perfect game, especially on offense. I think Florida's strength is on its defense. And I think it'll be, it'll be kind of a interesting emotional game for Coach Strong, given that, he still has players on that Florida team that he recruited.
That's right. He spent many years there as the defensive coordinator as well. Teddy Bridgewater, apparently there will be a big Heisman Trophy campaign for him next season. Is it legitimate?
Deservedly so. I think so. And I kind of looked at it like it officially started at Rutgers in that season finale. As much as Rutgers is disconnected from the New York City media, New York City media was at Rutgers for that game. And so Teddy Bridgewater, by the end of that game, they were leaving the stadium just in awe of what he did, especially being showing such grit playing through his injuries. So I think that helps. The national word will spread in beginning next year, and really in the Sugar Bowl too. This is another stage for him, but the beginning part of next season is when it'll really kick off.
Charlie Strong turned down the Tennessee job as did at least one other coach, but we've learned today that Tennessee has hired someone, right?
Butch Jones, the coach at Cincinnati, who also came at the same time Charlie came here. He's only been at Cincinnati 3 years. Butch Jones had interviewed at Purdue, interviewed at Colorado, and I think once he saw the way things were going with Charlie and Mike Van Gundy from Oklahoma State, both turning down Tennessee, I think he kind of hedged his bets and wanted to hold out for that job.
You've been covering UofL football all season. I assume you will be at the Sugar Bowl, but in the meantime, you've got basketball to worry about, right?
Yeah, and that's the funny thing about all of these rumors with Charlie Strong is the basketball team put on an incredible performance at College of Charleston, which beat Baylor, which beat Kentucky.
Right.
So that was supposed to be a more challenging game on the road in that kind of environment. They sold out. It's only a 5,000-seat arena, but it was sold out. Fans were charged up for it, and from the beginning, they just took them out of the game.
All right. C.L. Brown covers UofL football, basketball, and other sports for the Courier-Journal. C.L., thanks for coming by. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks so much. This was fun.
All right, this is Byline on WFPL. Some local government and other officials in southern Indiana are making financial preparations for lawsuits they may file challenging the imposition of tolls as a tool to pay for the downtown portion of the Ohio River Bridges project. WFPL's Devin Katayama has been covering the story and joins us now. Hi, Devin.
Hey, Rick. Thanks for having me.
So who's on board thus far? We have the most recent is the Jeffersonville City Council.
Right. Jeffersonville City Council took up the issue this week and did approve a $10,000 to put towards this fund. And $10,000 seems to be the amount that other entities are putting in as well. Clarksville Town Council put in $10,000 last month, as did the Southern Indiana, which is the New Albany and Clark Tourism Bureau, put in $10,000. And the group says they're also trying to raise some private funds, about $20,000 to fight bridge tolls eventually. How that's going to look, they're not quite sure yet. They're working with Mark Sullivan and Associates, which is out of Indianapolis. We tried to call them and reach out to them. They didn't return our calls. But that $50,000 is what their ultimate goal is, and Mark Sullivan apparently says if it goes above that, that they will continue to work on this issue.
Now, tolls a big part of the funding mechanism for the whole Ohio River Bridges project, which includes the an East End Bridge, a new downtown bridge here in Louisville, and of course the reconfiguration of Spaghetti Junction. Now, these entities are not necessarily opposed to tolls for the East End Bridge, right?
Right. New infrastructure is one argument, the fact that the East End Bridge is a new infrastructure, but also because this group that's putting this money towards this fund is really concerned specifically along the I-65 corridor. And Paul Fetter, who's a councilman for the Clarksville Town Council, was saying at their council meeting that there's a potential to lose around, $7.5 billion over a 30-year period. Where he was getting that number was from an economic development research group study, and that group's from Massachusetts. But in that study, you see that for the majority of the surveys that they did along businesses think that the project itself, the overall project, will actually improve business along that corridor. There's only a small handful of businesses who actually thought it would have some sort of negative impact. And actually, most of those businesses were restaurants, service industry businesses. So it's interesting to see the area that's been built up around the I-64 corridor and how it might affect, how tolling might affect, and how the bridges project might overall affect that area.
Has there been a timetable for filing these lawsuits?
Well, the lawsuit last month when I talked to Mr. Fetter, he was saying that they needed to file the lawsuit if it was against the federal government's record of decision, which came in summer. They needed to file it within 6 months, which is December, which is this month. Mr. Fetter tells me this week that they're more likely to, maybe not more likely to wait, but they it seems like they're waiting for the tolls to actually be set, which that timeline, there's no timeline for that. But once the tolls were set then they could act. They would have a basis to act because then they would know exactly what that kind of effect would have on the region. CART, which is the Coalition for Advancement of Regional Transportation, has filed its own suit, and it's kind of an overall suit against the project as a whole, ranging, I think it has 14 complaints in the suit that they filed. So that's kind of an overall suit that was filed on the record of decision, and then this other one might be just specifically tolls.
I said lawsuits. This would be one lawsuit with these three entities possibly involved.
Right, right. And those entities involved are, a lot of them are, or actually the leader is part of, which is Paul Fetter, is part of the, he formed the group No to Tolls in 2010, which opposed tolls as well. But it doesn't really have a name, so they're just kind of creating this fund at this point.
And their concern is it would be too burdensome on local businesses and commuters. But as you said, the tolls have not been set, and there's going to be a sliding scale for people who would frequently use the bridges.
Right. And at this point, I mean, that we've heard the proposal of about $1 for that frequent commuter who has that special device that they can go over the bridge, $2 for regular cars, $5 for commercial vehicles, and up to $10 for larger trucks. And also, the I reached out to some of the Metro Council members as well, because in 2010, there was a resolution going around with a handful, small handful of council members who were against tolls, but that was a different plan as well. But again, Tina Ward Pugh and Tom Owen, who were on that resolution, now say that it's not really a game that they've heard rumors about playing.
You can find out more about the Ohio River Bridges Project and opposition to tolls at our website, WFPL.org. Devin Katayama, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more of Byline in just a moment. This is Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline. I'm Rick Howlett. Earlier this year, Kentucky Auditor Adam Edlin released a report that criticized Jefferson County Clerk Bobbi Hoesklaw's handling of charitable funds and other practices in her office. Hoesklaw defended those practices at the time, and the matter was brought up again this week by Hoesklaw, who alleges through a PR spokesman that there may have been some political motivation behind that audit. Hoesklaw is a Republican, Edlin's a Democrat. WFPL's Philip M. Bailey is here to sort all of this out for us. Philip, welcome back to the program.
Rick, how you doing?
Fine, thank you. Let's start with the audit itself from Adam Edlin. What were some of his major findings?
Yeah, the audit, which came out in October, it found that the clerk's office was failing to properly account for funds that her office had raised for charities such as the WHAS 11 Crusade for Children, Metro United Way, and USA Cares Incorporated. Among the findings was that Hoesklaw paid, I think, $99,200 in Christmas bonuses to employees last year. That was another issue that came up, which is against the state constitution. She called it gifts in her handouts to those employees. According to the clerk's office, those bonuses were incentives for good work, but Edlin's office points out that was against state law. So it was interesting for this to come up you know, 2 months later in the way that it did, Holtzclaw hired, personally hired, PR man Larry Bissig, who owns a marketing firm here in Louisville, to hold a press conference, basically touting the letter from a Jefferson County attorney's office saying that they found no wrongdoing and no reason to go forward, no action was needed. So Bissig, in this press conference, not only does he defend Holtzclaw, but he really takes the fight to Edelin, who's becoming more and more of a state prominent official.
Predictably, the county attorney has found no wrongdoing. We have no problem, as I indicated earlier, at the clerk's office, making minor in-house accounting adjustments recommended by the auditor. The auditor has challenged the clerk's office to cease and desist raising money for charitable entities. This raises a concern for the public offices, as I indicated earlier, across the Commonwealth. In some ways, I have to indicate that the audit seems a bit mean-spirited and possibly politically motivated in some areas. Again, this is not political warfare. The governor's race doesn't start for 36 months. I certainly hope that that's not the intention of the auditor. And right now, that's not where we're going to go. Where we want to go is with good customer service and try to take the parts of the audit that are productive and implement them, but also question some parts of the audit that we have some serious questions regarding.
Now, Rick, as you mentioned earlier, Edelin is a Democrat. Mm-hmm. He's also the former chief of staff for Governor Beshear, and his name keeps coming up as a potential gubernatorial candidate in 2015. So that was what Mr. Bissig was talking about when he says he feels like this is politically motivated, that Mr. Edelin's office was targeting Holtzclaw because she is the only Republican official elected countywide here in Jefferson County. So that fight goes back and forth. Edelin, in his response letter to the county attorney, says, no, you misinterpreted and misrepresented what we were doing in our report, our findings in the report. So the fight continues.
A devil's advocate might argue that Bobbi Holtzclaw is keeping this ball up in the air because she may have political aspirations as well.
Yeah, she herself ran for governor in the last go-around. And Edelin's office, you know, in a statement released to WFPL, Edelin himself says he's disappointed because he feels that Ms. Holtzclaw is more concerned about her public image, maintaining that, than heeding the recommendations from the audit. You know, Ms. Holtzclaw has been in this office since 1999. She's very popular amongst local Republicans here in Jefferson County. So, you know, Edelin's office feels that she's taking more of a chance to defend her public image instead of addressing these issues. And I talked to Edelin's spokesperson, who said that, you know, many of the changes that they recommend have not been implemented. Therefore, you could see some of these same issues come up in next year's report.
And so the county attorney has said that they found no evidence of wrongdoing, right?
Yeah, in his view that there was no mishandling of funds. He also takes issue with the fact that Mr. Edelin's office raised the concern about the issue of Ms. Holtzclaw's office helping raise funds for private charities. That was something Mr. Bissig also went after, the idea that the Edelin's office was somehow suggesting public officials can't help private entities raise donations or raise funds. Edelin's office says, no, that's not what we're saying at all. We're saying that there was a mixing of those two funds, and that was the concern.
So has Edelin indicated there would be, or did he recommend any other action be taken?
Well, some of the recommendations from the audit is separating the funds. Now, Holtzclaw's office has outlined three different things that they're doing: a separation of the account activities. They're no longer going to use these gas cards. They're changing the use of gas cards on election day. They're going to have mileage logs for that, and they're going to eliminate the word gift from these salary adjustments, which Ms. Holtzclaw indicated they're still going to do. So even if they eliminate the word gift, there's still the question of, is that legal for her office to have those quote-unquote bonuses for employees during the Christmas season? It's still not really clear. And I expect this fight could continue if the audit next year has the same findings.
Before I let you go, Philip, I know you've been reporting on the fiscal cliff. And some local folks have been up to the White House this week to talk about participation of some sort along with the president.
Yeah, a delegation of social justice groups from Kentucky, the Louisville Fairness Campaign, Louisville NAACP, ACLU of Kentucky, and Planned Parenthood of Kentucky were at a meeting at the Public Engagement Office of the White House, along with a delegation from Tennessee, basically discussing how they could help the president send out his message on the fiscal cliff, his point of view on that. I talked to both Raul Cunningham, the president of the Louisville NAACP, and Michael Aldridge, the executive director of the ACLU. And I reminded both of them that, you know, while you're a delegation from Kentucky, at the end of the day, Kentucky is represented by Mitch McConnell, who has certainly not been the president's closest ally on the fiscal cliff negotiations. And Raul Cunningham pointed that out, saying that while the president won a mandate maybe from the country, he doesn't have a mandate from Kentuckians. So therefore, he sees the role of social justice groups as educating them on the importance of the fiscal cliff. Michael Aldridge from the ACLU pointed out that as long as we're dealing with getting the country's fiscal house in order, we can't deal with social justice issues like immigration reform. So that group was able to meet with White House officials, not really clear on how much headway will happen in a state like Kentucky, which is very conservative compared to other states, but still having a chance to have the ear of the White House is something that most social justice groups would not turn down.
Philip M. Bailey is WFPL's political editor. Philip, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rick.
This is Byline on WFPL. The Kentucky Farm Bureau is holding its annual meeting this week in Louisville. It has included a session called Agricultural Outlook, where agricultural economists offered their assessments and predictions for the industry. Members also heard from State Agriculture Commissioner James Comer, who's been updating them on the work of Kentucky's Industrial Hemp Commission, which we'll talk about in a moment, with Kentucky Public Radio's Kenny Colston, who's been covering the meeting and joins us now. Hi, Kenny.
Hey.
Let's start with the economist at this meeting. What are they saying about this year's receipts? They sounded very optimistic.
Yeah, surprisingly, that they project Kentucky to actually break the $5 billion mark when it comes to cash receipts in terms of agriculture. And that's all the way from your corn and your soybeans to your poultry, your livestock. That's across the board, which is surprising because it seemed like, and they even referenced this, you turned on the nightly news or listened to this show or anything else, and all you heard about was the extreme drought that the country was experiencing, especially Western Kentucky. But high market prices and exports and even they said local demand for local goods was really helping Kentucky's agriculture economy.
And I guess the drought really affected, corn. I don't know much about it. Corn more than anything, but crops like tobacco don't seem to do so badly in a drought.
Yeah, tobacco actually did well. And, of course, what buoys tobacco up is the fact the tobacco buyout payments, which those will be expiring soon, and that industry will have big questions then. Corn doesn't do so well. Soybeans, wheat, which is basically your main crops here in Kentucky. But despite, farmers planted more acres than they ever had before, and the fact that they had planted more acres and the prices were high because a lot of the yields were bad, a lot of damaged goods, that meant, supply and demand. They said that they did very well, and so there's only a few months left. They have to wait for November and December to fully come in, but they fully expect to break that $5 billion mark, which is a record.
And 2013, the prospect's even better, right?
Exactly, even better. They're projecting somewhere between $5.5 and $5.6 billion, which is, another half there. And they said the question was brought up, what about the fiscal cliff? What about the farm bill? All these other issues. And they said, yes, the general economy obviously dictates how well we do here in Kentucky in our ag economy. That being said, we think prices will continue to rise, that we think export-wise there will continue to be growing markets, and that even if the country goes off the fiscal cliff and doesn't do a farm bill, and worst-case scenario, ag and farmers will still be able to sell their goods.
Farming is such a gamble for many people, and weather, of course, can play a big role. Things can happen very quickly in the world economy. World prices for various commodities can affect what we see as well in terms of receipts.
Exactly. And so despite that, they say that the high prices in the world economy will actually, that demand will actually boost any, even if they had another drought. Of course, government insurance payments help get this as well. That's considered as a cash receipt. But most farmers do get insurance, so they count that just as they would anything else.
You also heard this week from Agriculture Commissioner James Comer, who's part of the Kentucky Industrial Hemp Commission. This is the group that's exploring the possibility of legalizing industrial hemp in Kentucky's crop that was huge way back when, before World War II and around that time.
Right, exactly. They're having their second meeting today, and what's going on is basically it's been 10 years since anyone's really done a good economic study of what hemp could mean in Kentucky. And the commission, thanks to grants that we talked about at their first meeting, I think they're going to use some of that money to pick a state university to commission a grant. As far as I know, they haven't picked one yet. But, you could reasonably say Murray State, Morehead State, University of Kentucky, even Western Kentucky University, any of those four and UK did the original study, could do the study again. They really want to have it done before February, which is the bulk of the legislative session next year, being a short session. And if they can get down that, whoever can do it the fastest and they think will have the most pull with lawmakers, that's probably who they'll pick. And it'll be up to them to really kind of convince lawmakers that this study will probably be used to convince lawmakers that, you know, there is a reason for us to do hemp from an economic standpoint.
This all always reminds me of the late Gatewood Galbraith, who was a big advocate for industrial hemp and enjoyed the other qualities of the cannabis plant as well. Will lawmakers have, is there a chance that they could pass some sort of legislation this time?
Comer is very optimistic, and what's really going to help him this time is that, you know, what appears to be the outgoing agriculture chairman in the state Senate, which would be Senator Givens, he appears to be taking the education chairmanship, which is vacant right now. If he does that, Senator Hornback, who is in Shelby County, he would probably be the agriculture chairman for that chamber. And Senator Hornback is a very close friend of Commissioner Comer's. And, you know, that would obviously get it its first real committee hearing, possibly pass it, could possibly get it through the state Senate. And then you have to jump through the hoops that are in the House. But, you know, I think it has a really good chance, even in a short session, to really rise above. One thing that we've talked about, you've got pension problems, you've got tax code problems, you've got higher education you can't fund. And if they get a study that says, hey, hemp can provide X amount of jobs and X amount of money, and, you know, they're talking about licensing it, so that's some revenue to the state, you know, it might be make enough economic sense that they just go ahead and do it.
We're talking with Kentucky Public Radio's Kenny Colston. He's been covering the Kentucky Farm Bureau's annual meeting this week in Louisville. And Senator Mitch McConnell is due to speak today, right?
That's right, later this afternoon.
Speaking of Senator McConnell, this brings me to Ashley Judd, because some news popped up this week about her, the possibility of her challenging or running for McConnell's seat.
Yes, another week, week that we talk about Ashley Judd and not one of her movies, but actually her being a U.S. Senate candidate. And the story this week is that Politico reported that she's talked to a pollster, that she's reached out to other U.S. senators. And, you know, those are big moves. I think she's even doing opposition research on herself. I don't know if she called McConnell for him to hand over that book early or how she's going about it. I don't know if she's calling people, hey, what do you think about Ashley Judd? You know, her grandma was not very kind to her in an AP story.
I saw that.
So anyways, long story short, apparently she's making very serious run at this. She's looking at it as hard as any candidate would be. But there's still questions from Kentucky Democrats whether she's a viable candidate. She can raise a lot of money, but the stances that she's taken in her personal issues would be ripe for McConnell to attack.
She lives in Tennessee now. She'd have to move. I guess there's still time. There would still be time to move to establish residency in Kentucky.
Yeah, I think it's only 1 year. So, I mean, she would have a while. She could possibly wait till November of 2013, I think. But that being said, you know, even U.S. Senator Rand Paul, I think she also owns a home in Scotland because of her husband, IndyCar race driver Dario Franchitti. That's where he's from. And so Paul, Senator Paul, joked that maybe she should run for parliament instead. So, you know, everyone's having a lot of fun with this. It appears she's taking the steps to be a serious candidate. We'll have to see whether or not she can really be a serious candidate.
Well, if not her, who? I think someone asked Governor Beshear this week if he would be interested in running for the seat, and he said no.
Yeah, a lot of people think Beshear, obviously coming off big victories, would be great to take on McConnell, although Beshear has already had his chance at that and lost by 20-something points in 1996. Beshear's not going to run. Another person is possibly former ambassador to Sweden, Matthew Barzin, who's a well-known Louisville businessman. And but Barzin appears to be taking a lot bigger steps. He's a co-chair of President Obama's second inauguration committee. That's a big job. Rumored to be in the loop for an ambassador post to Great Britain. And that's a pretty plum job as well. So I would have to think that he's really thinking broader than a U.S. Senate run. And he's probably doubtful at this point. Another name that you could possibly throw in is locally, I think a few people are wondering if Louisville Mayor Greg Fisher might want to take that run. Mm-hmm. He obviously rose to prominence in 2008, running in that primary, and would he take another shot at it?
Okay, before I let you go, this wasn't on our agenda, but I want to talk a minute about the upcoming General Assembly and some of the things that might be on the agenda. We talked about industrial hemp. Good chance that casino gambling will come back in some form?
Yeah, I literally just talked to Governor Beshear about that. He's in Louisville, and he says that he is still mulling over his options, but the amendment that we saw last year that did not pass the state Senate is unlikely to happen this time. He said that, that really protected racetracks. You couldn't build a casino within 60 miles unless the casino was at the racetrack. And Beshear told me that he thought, whether they protect the casino or the racetracks in the actual constitutional amendment or whether they do it in what's called enabling legislation after the amendment is passed, he's really open to it either way. He just wants the horse tracks to, obviously be protected. And so I think that's a big move because a lot of Republicans who voted against that said, well, you can't promise that much to one industry in the state constitution. Now that Beshear seems to be open to, protecting them on the back end instead of the front end, that could get them the votes needed to pass.
And this tax commission that he formed is on the verge of making some recommendations.
Yeah, they just wrapped up work yesterday. And so I talked to Beshear about that as well. And he said that, he's going to have to sit down with House Speaker Greg Stumbo and who appears to be the Senate President, Robert Stivers. But anyways, he said that he thinks that, what the commission finally recommended, that's going to be tinkered with and toyed with. He doesn't expect that to wholly be taken up, but he does expect that lawmakers will pass certain parts of it. He says that they're in such a dire need in the state from a revenue standpoint, something has to be done, and he said that he's going to get to work over the next couple weeks to make sure that something is.
Kenny Colston is the Frankfort Bureau Chief for Kentucky Public Radio and the Public Radio Network, which includes WFPL. Kenny, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Byline on WFPL. According to reports filed with the U.S. Treasury Department, Kentucky and Indiana have spent just a fraction of some $371 million they received from the federal government to help people who've been laid off keep up their mortgage payments. In Kentucky, it's called the Unemployment Bridge Program. In Indiana, they call it the Hardest Hit Fund. So why such low participation? We're here to talk about it is Chris Otz, who's been writing about it for the Courier-Journal. Chris, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Good to have you. First of all, how does this program work? Is it a loan program?
It is a loan, but it is a forgivable loan. So when you get into the program, the state puts a lien on your house. You have a closing, just like you would have a closing if you were refinancing or getting a new mortgage. But if you stay in the home for a certain period of time, in Kentucky it's 5 years, in Indiana it's 10 years, the loan is forgiven.
Oh, I see. And this is for people who have lost their jobs only, right?
Yes. The main way that the states tell whether you're eligible for the program is if you are receiving unemployment insurance or if you're eligible or if you have been recently. Kentucky, you can be a small business owner, and if you can document a drop in income from some sort of self-employment such as that, even if you're not covered by unemployment insurance, you can still get into the program. But Indiana pegs all of its eligibility to the unemployment insurance system.
So how much, or I should say, how little of this money has been distributed in the two states?
Yes. Kentucky is spending at a little bit of a faster clip than Indiana, and they've spent about $27 million, I believe, of about $150 million, according to the most recent quarterly reports on this. And Indiana has spent about $13 million of $220 million or so.
So still a lot of money in the bank. Why
yes.
aren't people getting on this?
Well, there are a couple of explanations. One is that this program just might not be very well known. Even though it is such a big benefit for homeowners who are in the program, the word has not necessarily gotten out. And the states say that they are really stepping up their outreach efforts. They're doing, aggressive radio ads and trying to get more people into the program. Another reason is that it almost sounds too good to be true. And it's true that there are a lot of scams out there for people who are facing foreclosure. They get letters, because this is all public record, and they get letters in the mail that say, hey, I can help you get out of this problem. You just need to pay me a certain amount or whatever. And so when a program comes along and says, hey, we can pay your mortgage, it sounds like a scam, and people might just pass on it.
And also there seems to be, I think you touched on this in your article, there seems to be some people might be hesitant to apply for what they perceive as welfare.
Yes, yes. That's what a couple of people I talked to for the story said, that they were sort of conflicted about it.
And but it's not. It's a loan. It is a forgivable loan.
It is a forgivable loan. Uh-huh. Yes. Well, the advocates for the program say that it's meant to be a bridge from unemployment to employment. Just kind of like unemployment benefits are supposed to be a temporary lift. They say that for people who have fallen on hard times, this program is meant to help them keep their home rather than go into foreclosure. And it only lasts for a year or for 18 months in Indiana. So it's temporary in nature. And the hope is that the homeowner will be able to obtain employment and get their financial house in order while the state will make their mortgage payments.
Now, is there a sunset provision on this program? Is it going to shut down after a while?
Yes. At the end of 2017, the unspent money will be returned to the U.S. Treasury. It was ultimately this money came from the federal bank bailout, and so the money will return to the government if it is unspent by the end of 2017. But the federal government says we really want the states to spend it and not have any money left over, and both Kentucky and Indiana say that they do intend to spend that money and to not have it hanging around by the end of 2017.
Where do people go to apply for this, to get loans?
Okay, so if you are a Hoosier, it is 877-GetHope.org, and the phone number is 877-438-4673. And if you're in Kentucky, the website is ProtectMyKYHome.org, and the phone number 866-830-7868.
And we'll put up some links to the information at our website, WFPL. Chris Ott from the Courier-Journal, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back with our arts segment in just a moment. Aaron Keene's going to talk to a couple of folks who were in the Lincoln film, musicians, and that's straight ahead. This is Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline on WFPL. I'm Rick Hellett, and it is time for our arts segment, and Aaron Keene joins us. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, Rick.
Before we get to your special guest, very excited about your guest today, but we want to talk about some things going on this weekend and this holiday season in the area as in terms of theater and other events. Lots of holiday productions underway.
So many holiday productions. A Christmas Carol is open at Actors Theater of Louisville, the 37th annual production of A Christmas Carol. Apparently, according to ATL, they are the second longest running production in the country. The Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis has them beat by a year. Lots of familiar faces returning, William McNulty as Scrooge. The production is beautiful, it's heartwarming, and essentially it's become more than a tradition. I feel like it's become more of a ritual, you know, going and attending and sort of experiencing Scrooge's journey to redemption along with him, even though, you know how it ends.
Yeah, but can't change that.
Right.
And you saw it last night, right?
I did. It's a beautiful production. Some of the standout moments include Lindsay Noel Whiting, who works with the Looking Glass Theater in Chicago. She is the ghost of Christmas past, and she comes down aerial silks and does lots of sort of flying during it. So very magical. Lovely, lovely production.
And it wouldn't be the holiday season without a production of The Nutcracker.
Exactly. If you're looking for another traditional Christmas arts event to attend, and The Nutcracker opens this weekend at Whitney Hall. This is the Louisville Ballet's annual flagship performance. And in very good news, live music is going. The Louisville Orchestra is going to be in the pit for the first 2 weeks of the run. This is a last-minute addition. Folks are pretty excited about this. I think you really can't beat live music with the ballet. So,
and there are some non-Christmas things going on. Savage Rose opens. I'm not going to pronounce this.
Well,
you pronounce it. Go ahead.
Yeah, nothing says Christmas like a politically motivated sex strike, I guess. Lysistrata is opened last night at the Mex, which is the black box-ish theater in the Kentucky Center. Mm-hmm. That's a Savage Rose classical theater production. They're a classical theater company, so they do lots of older texts. And Lysistrata is that sort of now iconic story of women banding together to try and put a stop to the Peloponnesian War, decide to stop having sex with the men. It's an old Greek drama, good old-fashioned political play.
is Lissa Strada, as I pronounced correctly,
yes.
And a very exciting film festival this weekend at the Dreamland Film Center as well.
Yeah, if you've already had your fill of Christmas carols, the Dreamland Film Center, which is the great new theater that the Louisville Film Society has opened in Nulu, they are putting on the Real Sounds film series starting tonight. There's Wooden Box, a documentary on Kentucky pop cellist Benso Lee, and also the Valtari Film Experiment, which is a collection of short films, including some fan-submitted creations for tracks for the Sigur Rós album Valtari. So kind of a cool music video compendium. Tomorrow, The Wild World of Hazel Atkins and The Dancing Outlaw, which is where we first met, West Virginia musical icon and lifestyle guru Jessica White.
Oh, Jessica, the great Jessica
yes.
White. All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Aaron. Now, let's meet your guest. Now, the film Lincoln has been critically acclaimed on many levels. For one, the production is just, I hear, is just terrific and lots of period authenticity. And a part of that is your two guests, right?
Absolutely. I'm here with the founder of the Kentucky Baroque Trumpets, Don Johnson. Say hi, Don.
Hello.
And Michael Tunnell, who is a member of the Kentucky Baroque Trumpets and a professor of music at U of L.
Hi there.
Hi, Michael. And you guys are part of President Lincoln's own band. You played in the flag-raising ceremony scene in the first, 15 minutes or so of Lincoln.
That's right.
So, Don, can you tell us how your ensemble got involved with the shoot?
It started with them wanting original, authentic instruments and not modern instruments, and that led them to the 8th Brigade Band, which I believe is in Minnesota, and also to Mark Elrod. And when they were in contact with Mark Elrod, he found out that there was an E-flat cornet solo in it, and he said, well, you need to get Don Johnson to play the E-flat cornet solo. And we were sort of in contest with the 8th Brigade for quite a while. I think California just kind of chosen them early. Eventually, I was in charge of choosing the musicians, the rest of the musicians, if we did it. And so I chose a lot of the musicians from the Kentucky Baroque Trumpets, including Mike. And I think looking at our website and the instruments that we had to offer, we had a lot of things to offer that the 8th Brigade couldn't do.
Okay,
or 1st Brigade, I'm sorry.
So for a filmmaker who is as sort of invested in authenticity as Spielberg is, and especially with this production, Michael, can you explain to me why any old band, any old military-type band would not do for this film?
Well, it's all about the sound. I mean, part of it is the look, I'm sure. Modern instruments have a different, distinctive look. The Civil War instruments are a very distinctive look. And beyond that, the sound is quite different. The pitch level of the 150-year-old instruments is at 458 for A, or around 450 to 458 A. And, of course, modern instruments generally are around 440.
Well, what does that mean for a person who's just, for like a layperson's ears?
Well, it's a little different different tone quality. For one thing, it's a much lighter sound.
Mm.
It's not as loud. It's, I hate to use the word delicate, but it's actually a little more, it's a very warm, round sound. The louder the instruments have gotten in modern times, there is somewhat a projection factor which can go towards stridency, and the historical instruments are really a much more elegant sound. I think elegant's a good word for that.
Also, and you said that this is film, so the look matters too. Don, can you tell me, maybe just using your average trumpet as an example, how a Civil War era authentic trumpet differs in look from the trumpets that we're used to seeing on stage today?
Well, the instruments that we used in the movie were all over the shoulders, which means that they point backwards instead of forwards.
Ah.
And the reason that they used over-the-shoulder instruments at that time period was because a lot of the time the band would be in front of the soldiers when they marched. So that way the soldiers could hear the instruments. So we used all over-the-shoulder instruments in the movie, and it was a true authentic sound. Nothing was dubbed over in Hollywood on that.
Wow, so you guys played live, and that's the sound yes. that you're hearing on the film.
Yes. Yes, and these are not reproduction instruments. These are actual 150-year-old instruments.
Where do you find a 150-year-old cornet?
A very good friend of mine, Mark Elrod, has the finest private collection in the world of over-the-shoulder instruments in his home. And so we could have chosen to use all of his, but there were some members that I chose in the group that had their own, so we let them use their own. But he could easily suit a whole band with his instruments.
Well, so when you're used to playing one type of instrument, how much modification, how much practice time has to go into changing your breath, your mouth techniques in order to play one of these older instruments?
Well, it's an adjustment. It is. But the quality of musicians that we have in our group is quite amazing, really. And their ears went right to what it should have been. And with people like Don is renowned in this style and in historic instruments in general. And with his guidance and leadership, we really quickly adapted. It was quite an amazing venture.
Well, so the Kentucky Baroque Trumpets is the ensemble that you lead, Don, and that you're drawing from for this band. And, you know, they say if it ain't Baroque, don't fix it. But it was a little bit, right? I mean, the difference between the modern valve trumpet and a Baroque trumpet is great. So you guys already have a lot of practice and time working on playing on instruments that are not necessarily taught in your average music school right now, right? So tell us a little bit about the Baroque trumpet.
Well, the Baroque trumpet is about twice as long as your modern trumpet, and it does not have valves. And it's extremely difficult to play. And that's why they have modern instruments today. You're more likely to miss, much more likely to miss a note on a Baroque trumpet than you will on either a modern trumpet or a piccolo trumpet. The piccolo trumpet's cut in half again. So, as an example, if you go to hit a G at the top of the staff with your piccolo trumpet, the two closest notes are a half octave away. If you go to hit a G at the top of the staff on your Baroque trumpet, you could hit the note a half step under it or a half step over it. So the margin of error is there's a great big difference.
It's a precision. It really can
be. And it also gives you a different overtone series, since it's which gives it its unique sound. Since it's 2 to 4 times longer than modern instruments, it has, again, a much warmer sound that blends better with string and voice.
So Civil War films, period films, are there, do they usually go as far as Spielberg did for that authentic sound?
No.
To my knowledge, we are the first ones that were ever used to where they used the soundtrack that live. Everything else has been dubbed over in Hollywood. And I think Mike said it right, that when we met Mr. Spielberg the first time, he, of course, said hello and how are you all, et cetera. And then he said, let's hear the solo.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that, talk about pressure. But the reason was, I think he wanted to see what our sound was like and were we going to have to use a click track, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And we didn't.
And so this is something, though, that Civil War historians and buffs would notice if they were watching a film that just had any old trumpeteers
really
in it.
Really, musicians will notice.
Yes.
I know. Keen ears will hear the difference.
There, in fact, there's another place in the film where there was a band going down the street, if you remember that, and you can tell that wasn't authentic. That was a modern sounding in the studio recording that was used there.
That was probably Chicago Symphony.
Oh. Could have been.
The soundtrack.
Yeah, you can hear. You can definitely hear a difference in the sound. Yeah.
So, how long was the film shoot?
Well, we showed up on a Saturday, and we were in makeup, hair, and costume for I don't know. I want to say like 6 to 8 hours. It was a long day. Then we had rehearsal. Then we had a day off on Sunday, and the shoot was actually early in the morning. Our call was 5 a.m.
Wow.
And I'd say the shoot was an hour and a half to 2 hours long.
Okay.
No, it was three.
Oh, it was three.
It was 8 to
11.
See,
it was so much fun.
It went from 8 to 11.
I remember being very cold. That was the biggest thing.
Yes, it was in
a little authenticity
30s.
For you.
It was, in the low
it was really
30s.
Cold.
Low 30s that morning.
And so this is the ensemble's first film, but not its last, right? Can we talk about the next project, Don?
Well, someone that was employed by DreamWorks was asked to work for the National Geographic film called killing Lincoln, and they gave them our information. So I bought the uniforms that we used in the first movie, and with the hope that when we were allowed to talk, we had to wait a year before we had to sign non-disclosure statements. But after a year, that we would have our group and call it President Lincoln's Own. You can go to Kentucky Broke Trumpet's website and see now we've included President Lincoln's Own in our group. So we did a National Geographic this past summer, used our uniforms in that, and we also played at Gettysburg back in November for Mr. Spielberg again, and we have some real nice photos of that.
Great. And so the National Geographic film Killing Lincoln comes out when?
2013 is all I've heard. So it comes out early 2013.
Okay. So if you haven't seen Lincoln yet, you can keep an eye out for President Lincoln's Own band there in the first one, the 15, 20 minutes or so of the film.
Yeah. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks to Don Johnson and Michael Tunnell of the Kentucky Baroque Trumpets. We'll look forward to the film. And thanks to you, Aaron Keene, WFPL Arts and Humanities reporter. That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information about topics discussed on Byline, visit WFPL.org. Byline is produced by the WFPL News staff. Our production team is led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. I'm Rick Howlett. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.